Our main speaker tonight is John.
Good evening. I'm John. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank the first two speakers and thank Nye and Ron B. for nominating me to be here tonight. I've actually known that I would be the speaker tonight for the last 2 months. And for the last week, I have been giving great qualifications in bed every night. I spoke to the church, and they absolutely refused to allow me to bring my bed here tonight. So I am going to be qualifying standing up. My sobriety date is October 14th, 1992. My sponsor is Bob B., and he has a sponsor. I have a few sponsees. I've worked the steps a few times. I practice the traditions to the best of my ability. My home group is the Templeton Group. We meet Wednesday nights, 6:15. We're on 55th Street between 1st and 2nd. You're all welcome to join us and visit. Just don't all come on the same night. You know, I am an alcoholic, and that's something I didn't realize for a long, long time, till after I came into AA. My story is I had a terrific childhood, the kind of childhood I don't hear too often when I hear people qualify. My 84-year-old mother came into New York a few weeks ago, something she rarely does. She doesn't like to fly. And, you know, my sister and I and my aunt and uncle and my cousin and my wife, we all got together at my sister's house, and we had one of those rare days where the whole family was together, you know, for the first time in a few years, quite a few years. And in the course of the day, my sister came out with a storage box of old photographs, probably 1,000 of them. And it was like Christmas to me because many, many of them I had not seen in over 50 years. Every one I just saw a happy child, smiling, a lot of love, a lot of family around. You know, neither one of my parents are alcoholic. And, you know, it was just wonderful memories that I hadn't seen or thought of her in so many years. It really brought back a lot, and I was very grateful to steal about 150 photos. Just the times at the beach and the bungalow colonies, growing up with my grandparents and seeing old photos and things like that. My father, who was the most amazing person I've ever known in my life. You know, I'm going to give you a little history since I have some time, a little background family history. Excuse me. My mother is the oldest of three daughters to my grandparents. My grandfather was a habitual gambler, tyrant, rageaholic, very abusive. My mother and her sisters were terrified constantly. He ran the house with an iron fist. My father was the youngest of six children, and his father, my grandfather, supported eight people ironing shirts during the Depression. And so they came from very, very humble backgrounds, very poor, especially my dad. And I remember my dad told me as I was growing up that he didn't think he was wanted. His father never told him that he loved him, and he never got a present from his dad in his entire life. And that really, you know, I saw how much pain that caused him. And as a result of that, my sister and I were given everything. I had a childhood that was just magnificent. The family always ate dinner together. My father was the type, never brought trouble, his troubles home. He was always cheerful, and, we'd go out and play after school, come home for dinner, everybody ate together. And, you know, that's my early childhood. You know, I always felt a little different, you know, from an early age. I for the first 10 years, I was wearing orthopedic shoes for flat feet. And, you know, when I was around 12 years old, we moved from a small apartment in Rego Park to a house in Far Rockaway. And this was a big deal. It was a real awkward age for me, you know. Things were popping up that weren't there before. And I was constantly comparing myself with other guys because I didn't know where I fit in. You know, I didn't have the right haircut, the right clothes. I had these Elvis Presley eyeglasses, aviator eyeglasses that didn't fit my head. And I always felt like, you know, I didn't belong anywhere. I was always out of place. I remember thinking when I was 10 years old, I wanted to be 13. When I was 15, I wanted to be 18. When I was 18, I didn't know what I wanted to be. But, you know, I coasted through junior high school. And around 13, I found alcohol. And that freed me. My first drink was my first drunk. My sponsor has a saying he likes to say. He says, I don't know if I was born an alcoholic, but after I took that first drink, an alcoholic was born. And I certainly relate to that. Although I definitely had isms, and there were signs very early on in my life that, that I was a little different than other kids. I remember being, I never learned lessons easily. You know, and that's a trait of an alcoholic. We have to bang our head against the wall many, many times before something sinks in. And that was always the case. I didn't like to be told what to do. I didn't like authority. And, when I was 3 years old, I took a bobby pin from my mother and I stuck it in the light socket and electrocuted myself. And then I did it again. So this was just the beginning of my career of learning things the hard way. I skated through junior high school with a 65 average because I was too busy getting high and drinking every day. This is around 1970 in Far Rockaway. This is after Woodstock. It was the dry goods capital of the world. I considered myself a dry goods specialist. My progression was textbook. You know, I started out with marijuana and wine and beer and graduated to the vodka and the heavy drugs and things like that. And it was always for effect. You know, we've all crossed that invisible line when we became alcoholics. I don't think I ever drank socially. You know, we would be in a friend's house and sitting in a circle with a bottle, and they'd be passing it around, and when it got to me, I would take the biggest swig, and they'd have to pull it out of my hand, and usually at the end of the night, I was the guy propped up against the wall with my chin on my chest and drool coming out of my face. So this was how I liked to get drunk. And for me, you know, I wasn't a big fan of alcohol, I got to tell you, because it was very hard for me to control. I went right from buzz to drool. It hit me in the legs but it did wonders for me. It made an inhibited kid feel like he was brave and feel like he could talk to girls and feel like he could be a fool and not care about it. And it just gave me wings until the sky closed in. So that was my progression through high school. When I was around 20 years old, I got my first apartment. Now, we've all heard of man caves. This was a cave with a man in it. This apartment was $70 a month in Long Island City, three rooms. The only heat came out of the side of the stove. In the winter, it was freezing. I slept with a kerosene heater next to the bed. The entire place smelled like kerosene. I ate, slept, and drank in bed. My one possession was a color TV. My living room had an old love seat and a wooden spool that I found outside that Con Ed wraps their cable around. That was my coffee table. And I had gotten a job out of high school selling diamonds on 47th Street. And I thought I had arrived because now the brakes were gone. You know, I could really drink and do what I wanted the way I wanted to. I was right near the Queensbridge Projects, a very, very dangerous area in those days. It probably still is. I wouldn't go back there now with a bodyguard. You know, it was an exciting time. My sister lived right above me. She was paying $65 a month. So, you know, around this time, I fell in love for the first time. I was 21. And a girl I met in a bar. And doomed from the start. You know, I had absolutely nothing to offer. You know, two nickels to rub together. Every cent I made was to feed the gorilla, who was getting bigger. And, of course, you know, it was not the kind of apartment you really want to bring a lot of girls back to. But, you know, I was incredibly codependent and needy and empty and wanting and felt that this was going to save me. And when it ended a few months later, I was so brokenhearted that I actually went into a depression that lasted 2 years. And, you know, I was brought up to believe that a man doesn't cry and a man, you know, toughs it out and you don't talk about your feelings and things like that. And I kept all of this inside for a long time. And I think this is the first time I've ever spoken about this. You know, and that's how I went about my days. You know, just not wanting to live because I thought I'd never fall in love again. I thought nobody would ever love me. I was unlovable. I had nothing to offer. And I felt like the loser and the failure that I was. I call these my lost years because for a couple of years after that, I was bouncing from job to job to job. You know, just trying to find where I fit in, where do I belong, and did many, many different things. I was a cab driver. I was a truck driver. I was a bank guard. I was a concrete inspector. I was a waiter. I was a pastrami slinger, a restaurant manager. All of these things, you know, very nocturnal. You know, I would, alive and working at night and sleeping through the day. And it got to the point where I was drinking so much and using so much drugs that, you know, I became unemployable because, you know, I would just drink until I passed out and wake up when I came to. I couldn't hold a job. I couldn't be trusted to do anything. My alarm clock wasn't working anymore, wasn't waking me up. At this point, I was in another apartment and sleeping on the floor of an air mattress that had a leak. And I had the phone company call me every morning to give me a hotel wake-up call because I figured a phone would ring next to my ear and that would get me up. But, you know, God has been wonderful because I never thought I would ever make it to AA. You know, I didn't come here willingly. I didn't want to get sober. I didn't want to get clean. I was willing to take this to the bitter end, you know, and you know, through the grace of God, my cousin Mitchell, who's 28 years sober, you know, was my last running partner. He decided he wanted to get sober and went to his folks and told them, you know, that he couldn't do this anymore. And by the way, John's a crack addict and, needs help. So, you know, he ratted me out and it was a family intervention. And a week later, I found myself on my journey through therapeutic community, a couple of detoxes, two 28-day rehabs, and, you know, just thought, what the hell happened? What is going on with my life? And It ended up that I was shipped off in the summer of 1989 to Kansas City, Kansas, to a Salvation Army halfway house. And I stayed there for a month until they asked me to leave because I still didn't follow directions that well. But during that time, you know, they were taking us to a big AA meeting clubhouse. It was the biggest clubhouse in Kansas City, Kansas. And all the detoxes and halfway houses and groups would converge there and, you know, and get their AA meeting and go back to where they were. So when I was asked to leave, one of the counselors gave me a $20 bill. He said, "This is not a loan. You don't have to pay it back. You keep this and you use that until you get on your feet, until something happens. And if you get sober, I want you to pass that $20 bill on to the next guy." So, you know, I walked out of the halfway house with a suitcase and a $20 bill. And I went and I found a place and I sold a pint of blood for another $20. And I walked to the AA clubhouse that I'd been going to meetings at and where I first heard the message of recovery. And there was a manager there, an old guy named Woody, and I went to him and I said, you know, I don't have a job yet. I don't have a place to stay. Can I stay here? You know, and would you let me stay here? Because it used to be a detox. And the strange thing was, when I left there, I wasn't afraid for the first time in my life, and I was always afraid, you know. I just didn't think that God dropped me in Kansas and was going to leave me there. I thought everything was happening for a reason, even though I didn't understand what it was. Turned out that day I got a job. You know, a couple of the feelers that I had out there, one of them came through. I got a job, and this guy Woody said, "I'm going to let you stay in a room here, and it's going to be $70 a week." And it was just a cot and a footlocker and a little 12-inch black and white TV. And I had the keys to the place. And the only rules were, you know, no girls. And, you know, I had to pay my rent on time. So I got a job working in a sweat factory in Fairfax, Kansas, building office furniture for $5 an hour. And I would walk in there. And actually, they would pick me up in the morning because I didn't have any transportation. And I wasn't speaking to my parents at this time because they would practicing that tough love stuff, and they didn't want to hear from me, you know. So, you know, I would go there, and I would see a mountain of parts taller than me, and my heart would sink, and I'd say, "Wow, this is my job for the day," and it was 95-degree heat. And slowly, day by day, I had somebody who was teaching me. I was slowly working my day load and getting through it. And starting to feel good about myself. And I was going home to meetings, and, you know, there were meetings around the clock. It was sort of like the 79th Street Workshop kind of place, lots of meetings. And I would wake up on a Sunday morning, come out of my room scratching myself, and I'd be in a meeting. You know, there'd be 30 people sitting in a room, and AA is very strong there. And I had a guy that grabbed me, put me under his wing, said, "I'm your sponsor." He took me to hospitals and institutions. He took me to prisons. He got me working steps. I did my first fourth step while I was there. And I picked up a girlfriend along the way. You know, I thought it was, terrific. I started getting self-esteem. I started feeling good about myself, you know, by doing an honest day's work. And, you know, I was afraid to come back to New York because these are my people, places, and things. And when I did finally come back, after about 3 months out there, you know, I went to a different fellowship. And I managed to stay sober a little bit, and I picked up because, you know, I'm a chronic alcoholic, and I'm a chronic relapser, and I was. And so, you know, I got my old job back when I came back, and I started getting sober. I met my wife, my now wife, selling diamonds. She was the competition, you know, the salesperson at the next counter. And I thought, you know, this was a wonderful, wonderful person, somebody I'd never thought that I could ever would ever be attracted to somebody like me. And, you know, someone with such high integrity and moral standard that, you know, she just raises the level of my game just being around her. So, you know, we started dating and we got married. And, you know, I got sober in October of 92. We got married in March of 93. And we opened our own business in August of 94. And, you know, we're still in business. I'm still sober, and I'm still married, and it's all only because I'm still sober. You know, my parents were thrilled. You know, I had always been such a disappointment to my father, who I adored his whole life. And when he saw me finally get sober, he was my biggest fan. He would come to all my early anniversaries, and you know, this is the only program that'll take a zero and make him a hero. You know, and you know, he in 2008 he got diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and he lived for 2 months from that diagnosis. And he was an amazing guy. You know, he throughout my whole life he always told me how much he loved me, and you know, and. So when he got sick, I went out to Florida. I would spend a lot of time with him as much as I could. And he was the most spiritual, humble guy I've ever known. And he would share things with me that just blew me away. When he was dying, he would tell me things like, you know, death is God's last gift to the living. And on some strange level, you know, he took all the fear out of it for all of our family, because he was in wonder. You know, he was just in awe of the whole process, and he did it. He met his fate without question, without asking why or why me, and you know, was concerned about us. And you know, he told me a few days before he went into a coma that. You know, that he was very proud of me, and that he loved me, and he wouldn't trade me for anything in the world, even with all of the heartache that I gave him, you know, through my life. And that's the gift of this program. I mean, where else would you hear something like that? Where else could I have, you know, been around if I wasn't sober to hear that from my dad? He passed away listening to Andrea Bocelli singing Per Amore, and his whole family around him, and it was just a wonderful way to go, I guess. You know, I miss him every day. So, you know, it's been a journey, because, like I said, I didn't think I was an alcoholic until I got here. It was a case of bringing the body, the mind will follow. I came here thinking I had a drug problem, and alcohol was just one of the things I used. But I'm an alcoholic because I can't have even one. And that was the hardest lesson for me to learn. And that's why I had a few relapses, because, you know, I thought that after a while, maybe I could just maybe have a drink, you know. But one thing would always lead to another. It would be a very short time before I was doing my drugs of choice. And, you know, so I'm so grateful that, you know, I finally got the message, because I don't learn things easily. And, you know, so many wonderful things have happened. You know, my life took off after I got married and after I got sober. I've been able to travel all over the world. I've been to, you know, I have the freedom to do anything today, where my world used to be so small, it was one room, and I was locking myself in that room with the one person trying to kill me. And today, I get to travel, I get to do anything, I can go anywhere. I've been to Vegas 16 times, I've been on 23 cruises. These are the most active places in the world. This is where you go when you want to get drunk. And I haven't had to have a drink, you know, and, you know, God has just just been wonderful, just been blessed me beyond anything I deserve. You know, I have a life today that I actually love, and a job that I actually love. And ironically, this is the same job that I used to go to and dread. How am I going to get through 8 hours until I could drink? So something shifted, and, you know, it must be sobriety. You know, I get to ride my motorcycle through Central Park every day and sleep with three females every night, only two of which are dogs. And I get to share my life with the most wonderful woman who, you know, and we work together. I got to mention this. We work together 6 days a week, 8 hours a day, elbow to elbow, in a 9-foot space smaller than a jail cell. Now, I proposed on Alcatraz, and I'm in a space smaller than a jail cell, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. We get to share everything together, and she is my partner, my love, and the love of my life. And I'm just so grateful to be able to be here today and to, you know, share the message that don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle, because, you know, I'm an alcoholic who never thought he was an alcoholic until he got sober, until he came to AA, you know, and I'm so grateful, and thank you.